psychologist, an author, and a veteran broadcaster. But most importantly, he's a dad. Welcome to Dr. Bill Meyer Live on the Faith Radio Network. Stay tuned for a faith and culture connection, a biblical perspective on current events, and practical family advice with psychologist Dr. Bill Meyer. You can join the conversation by calling 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Now, let's join Bill Meyer live.
Welcome. It is so nice to have you with us today on this Saturday in the Upper Midwest. We appreciate you taking Faith Radio with you wherever you are. Is righteous anger really righteous? Is it possible for Christians to respond to offense without being offended? I'm not really sure, but we're going to be talking to an author and radio host and master storyteller who makes that claim. His name is Bran Hansen, and he's going to be joining us in just a few minutes here on the Faith Radio Network. I think what you're going to find what he has to say very provocative. Brant has this new book out called Unoffendable, How Just One Change Can Make All of Life Better. And we'll be talking to Brant and giving you a chance to ask him questions, because you may find that you don't necessarily agree with everything he has to say. So that's coming up here in just a bit on the Faith Radio Network. First up, though, if you're a parent and you have teenagers who play soccer, some important research that you should know about. Just how safe is high school soccer? Well, when it comes to concussions, the answer might surprise you. Soccer has been increasing in popularity here in the U.S. as a high school sport. And of course, now with the U.S. women winning the Women's World Cup, that's probably going to increase big time, in the next year. But according to a new study, what's also been growing is the number of concussions among young soccer players. This is pretty scary. Researchers sampled 100 different high schools across the country, and they figured out that over a 9-year period, those schools reported 627 concussions among the girls and 442 among the boys. Yeah, the girls were beating up on each other more than the boys were. Now, most of these concussions, you might think, are they caused by heading the ball? You know, when you hit the ball off your head into the goal or to another player? No, actually, they were caused by physical contact with another player. The study found that the rates of concussions in girls and boys high school soccer has risen over the past 9 years. Researcher Sarah Fields with the University of Colorado Denver says the rate is certainly lower than football. Football is more than double that. But even though high school football has soccer beat in terms of concussion risk, soccer is still the second leading cause of head injury among female athletes. Now, as you may know, concussions can cause a whole variety of problems. Memory loss, they can cause mood changes, they can cause problems with sleep, and those issues can last sometimes for several months because your brain has basically been scrambled and your white and gray matter is all jumbled up in there. And now reports are starting to trickle in that in concussions, in soccer, just like in football, they can lead to lasting brain damage. My gracious. And you know, of course, soccer players don't wear helmets. Now, Dr. Fields and her colleagues found the most effective way to reduce concussion risk is to enforce rules against rough play on the field or the pitch in soccer. To enforce rules against rough, yeah, as if that's going to happen, right? Girls, be nice. No elbows to the head. you know, you think about how competitive our society is right now, and you think about the number of parents who are trying to get their kids into college on soccer scholarships. I don't think so. I don't think these girls are going to play nice. I think this really does concern me. And hopefully schools will start taking this seriously. But that remains to be seen. Okay, are you looking forward to retirement? Is it something to be excited about, or is it something to dread? You may have heard that, maybe you've heard, you know, news stories that a lot of people end up languishing in retirement. They're bored out of their minds, and they miss the stimulation of daily work. They think they're going to be excited about retirement and then, you know, looking forward to spending more time with their grandkids and, and going golfing and going fishing. And but then they find that they really miss working. They really miss that daily stimulation. So is that really true? Well, a team of researchers decided to find out. And here's what they learned. In reality, retirement quickly boosts your life satisfaction, and big improvements in your health show up just a couple years after retiring. Researchers at Utah State say the positive changes that people experience after retirement have a continuing impact, and they don't fade over time. I thought this was fascinating. What they did is they looked at 20,000 Americans over the age of 50 in the Health and Retirement Study, National Health and Retirement Study. They did in-depth interviews with these people. And these 20,000 Americans over the age of 50 were asked about every aspect of their lives, including physical and mental health. And what the researchers did is they followed up with these people every 2 years until they died. And they've been doing this for years. So what did they learn? They found the majority of retirees reported feeling healthier and more satisfied with their lives right after they stopped working. And that didn't fade over time. They also found that just a couple years after retirement, these people began showing significant improvements in their health. The researchers say the delay, three or four years delay in improvements in health, may be because when somebody has more time to devote to healthier habits, like less stress at work and more exercise because they have more time and probably less snacking in the employee kitchen. The results appear after a couple of years because you retire. Now you've got more time to go walking and bike riding and swimming and go to the gym, and maybe you're less stressed out. And so 3 or 4 years after people retire, they're healthier. Let's see, how many years until I retire? 20, 25, 25. Too many. Well, it's 11:13, and coming up next, we're going to talk to my friend Bran Hansen about his new book, Unoffendable, How Just One Change Can Make All of Life Better. Stick with us here on the Faith Radio Network.
Continues right now, and we want to hear from you. Call us at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. Now, here's Dr. Bill Meyer again on Faith Radio.
And welcome back. Write that number down if you want to spell it out, 877-93-FAITH, because you may want to call in and have a question for our guest here this hour. His name is Brant Hansen. Brant is a radio host who has won multiple National Personality of the Year awards. He also works extensively with an organization called Cure International. They are a worldwide network of hospitals that brings life-changing medical care and the good news of God's love to little kids with treatable conditions all around the globe. Brant lives in Northern California with his wife, Carolyn, and his two kids. And today, he joins us to talk about his new book, Unoffendable, How Just One Change Can Make All of Life Better. And Brant, welcome to Faith Radio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on, man.
Well, before we dive into your book, first of all, tell us a little bit about your radio show, because I'm sure our listeners will, their curiosity will be piqued when they find out what you do every afternoon.
Well, I'm on a bunch of Christian stations across the country, and I talk about Jesus a lot, and it's kind of goofy, too. I let people know I have quirky interests and whatnot, so we, talk a lot about sci-fi and goofy things, but it's primarily just trying to help people understand how good God is. And so that's what I do, and it's a syndicated deal where I'm on a bunch of stations.
And you know what? You talk about your mauve pants sometimes, which I tuned in one day. I was driving in New Hampshire, of all places. I was driving in New Hampshire near beautiful Lake Winnipesaukee, and I was scanning across the FM dial trying to find some Christian music. And I stumble across Brant Hansen, and he's talking about his mauve pants. And you had, I think, a three-minute sermon applying life or theological truth to mauve pants. Branson, unique individual, I must say.
Well, I can't remember how I tied it in theologically, but I'm still in awe because I went to Kohl's where they have like 80% off rack, you know, and I got this thing for like $1.50 and they fit great, but I didn't know what a sensation or what a point of mockery I would be at work because they're mauve. Like they fit, they're $1.50. I thought that would earn respect, but it turns out it doesn't.
$1.50. I'd wear mauve for $1.50. I would.
That's what I thought.
Not chartreuse. I would wear mauve.
No.
So. No. Oh, gosh. Well, now, some of our listeners may be familiar with the I Am Second movement, which is designed to inspire Christians to live for God and live for other people. And the I Am Second website features these different video testimonials by celebrities and by ordinary people from all over the world in different walks of life. They share their stories, and you are featured on an I Am Second video. Can you tell us what you shared in that video, Brent?
Yeah. I just was talking about, again, it's God's goodness, but I have Asperger's syndrome, and anybody who's got a kid with it or knows somebody with it will have some understanding of how I grew up. My son has it as well, but I also went through a kind of a difficult upbringing in some ways beyond that. And I have another issue physically, which draws attention with my eyes. But all that said, what's been weird is I've seen over the course of my life how God's taken the weaknesses and made them into something that can be used to bless other people. And much as when you're going through something, it's really difficult. I mean, social life in middle school for anybody is difficult, but you add in Asperger's into that in high school and whatnot. All the stuff I can see God's hand in it now. But I couldn't then. I was like, why do I have to be this way? Why is this happening? But now I can see, you know what, God's taken that stuff and he's changed my heart in certain ways. And I just wanted to encourage other people too, because we've all got stuff. And it's remarkable how good he is to take our stuff and turn it into something that winds up being an expression of his love for other people.
You know, I'm guessing, Brent, that during your radio show and when you're out in public meeting people, that your own struggles, your own weaknesses, your own thorn in the flesh, when you share that, it can be so freeing to other people, especially to teenagers who are dealing with issues and feel isolated and feel like nobody loves them. Is that true?
That is totally true. That is, I've learned that over and over and over, that people don't relate to you for being cool, and I'm not, so this works out great. But they relate to you because they see weaknesses. And again, it's all that God can be glorified. It's like the story when the guy's born blind and they're debating it in the Bible. Like, why is he this way? Who sinned? Whose fault? And Jesus said, it's so that God can be glorified. And I see that with all sorts of people who have more obvious issues or special needs or troubles that they've gone through. Like, is it possible that while this wasn't God's intent with the world, but he still redeems it? And when people see that, I do think they see hope, and they're like, okay, God's writing a story. I just don't know the end of it yet. And that is beautiful, and it makes me feel like doing this whole thing is worth it. I'm sure you've experienced that too.
And I'm guessing, Brent, you probably hear from young people all the time on your show. And it just seems like in today's world, there are just so many kids, so many teenagers, so many young adults who are in so much pain, and they have nobody to turn to. A lot of times their family has broken up. Yeah, they're not plugged into a church community. They feel isolated because, you know, they don't have a thousand Facebook friends. They're the kid at school who is, you know, just kind of socially ostracized. And then we see these kids who take their own lives, and oh man, I heard about one this past week, and it just breaks my heart. And I think it's a challenge to all of us as adults to be paying attention. Pay attention, man, to the kids around you and your kids' friends, right?
Yeah, and just the way we structure our culture is just so messed up, our larger culture. And in some cases, our church culture, unfortunately, too, where it still exalts people with certain skills and abilities and how they look and whatnot. But
the cult of Christian celebrity, hey. Troubles me. You look at, you know, you're in radio, you understand this. You look at even the Christian music industry, and there's just this distorted upside down emphasis on popularity and physical attractiveness and coolness. And man, that is just so contrary to the Bible.
In this, I would say, and I've argued this, I wrote an article for CNN last year, CNN.com, about, it's called Mr. Spot Goes to Church. Mm. It was about being somebody who has Asperger's or being cut out of a different cloth. But you know what? I think we have an advantage when it comes to relating to Christ, and that is we understand the underdog thing. I think we implicitly get, I'm talking about people who have Asperger's or on a spectrum, we implicitly have compassion for people at the bottom. Mm. It's part of our makeup. It's the way things work. And that so resonates when I see, I don't cry at worship services with music that repeats over and over. And it might be really beautiful, a great song that everybody else is emotionally relating to. That doesn't move me. What does move me is when I see redemption in action, or I see the first or the last becoming first. And I know a lot of people who have Asperger's, and that is the thing that attracts them to Jesus, because he's blunt, and he says things that are out there, and he makes the culture look odd and upside down. And man, that's exactly how we feel all the time. Like, this doesn't make any sense, the way this culture is built. And I think we have an advantage because it doesn't make sense. It really is upside down. And so I do think there is an encouragement there. I think God equips us differently for different things, but that's actually a blessing.
Well, I appreciate, Brent, your honesty and your writing and what you do on the radio. And again, for folks that haven't seen your video, the I Am Second video, I'd encourage you to Google that and check that out. Let me ask you, just got about 4 minutes left before our break here, but let me ask you a little bit about your work with Cure International, because I just learned about this organization through our friend Paul just in the last year or two. They're doing some really amazing things. Tell us about Cure and what you do with them.
This has been like the best kept secret in the Christian world, and I'm not exaggerating. Like, and it's because I asked about this, because I'm like, why? How come I haven't heard of you? Here's Christian hospitals that are dedicated overtly to Jesus and pray with the patients, and they have a spiritual department. It's a ministry at these top-notch hospitals around the world. I'm like, how come I've never heard about this? This is incredible. Mm. What's happening? These people are turning, by the thousands, turning their lives to Christ in hospitals because of the healing and the ministry. And they're like, well, we don't spend much time on PR. We're a bunch of doctors. Mm. We're actually doing surgeries. I'm like, oh, you're actually doing it. But the number one provider of club foot surgeries in the world is Cure.
Wow.
You know, the number one for cleft palate, all these correctable things that people in their cultures are considered cursed. They're cursed by God or the gods. And they're told, you've done something wrong. And it's always mom. Mom did something wrong when she was pregnant. You're being punished by God or the gods. You need to do penance, need to sacrifice chickens, give us your money, whatever it is. And here come the Christians saying, oh, no, no, you're not a freak. You're not a monster, whatever they've called you in your village. We love you. Mm. And God, when they come in the door at the hospital, these kids, instead of being rejected, they're held. And for the first time in their lives, in their mom's lives, they're seeing their child loved. And the receptionist, the doctors will grab the child. Can I hold her? Mm. Oh, what a beautiful child. Kids with hydrocephalus. And it's joy, and it's all done in the name of Jesus overtly. It's not a halfway thing where it's like, well, we'll just take care of the physical and we'll see what happens. No, it's both. And I am so thankful to be a part of it. I can't heal kids, but at least I have a microphone and I can play a role in this, because this is what Jesus did. He healed and he proclaimed the kingdom of God, and he sent out his disciples to do the same thing. And it's still, all these stories that happen remind me of stuff out of the New Testament.
Have you had a chance to actually travel overseas with Cure?
Oh, yeah. I've been to the hospital in Kabul, Afghanistan 3 times, and I've also been to their hospitals, a couple hospitals in Africa. It's phenomenal when you meet these people who are the absolute low of the low, and then they're rejected by their own people. And a mom is just desperate enough to spend her life savings on a one-way bus ticket to this hospital that might be able to heal her kid. Mm. And she walks in the door, and she's loved. You can understand why people are drawn to a Jesus. Like, they go back to their villages and people are like, what happened? Jesus happened.
Wow.
So Oh, yeah, I couldn't get enough of it. And, Bill, if you ever see it, go with me sometime. I wish I could take everybody. But when you see it, you're like, this is Christianity. This makes sense. We're telling people that he's reversing the curse as far as the curse is found. We're saying, no, not cursed, loved. God has not abandoned you. So that's what we do.
Well, I'm going to take you up on that offer. And, boy, thank you, Rand. Once again, that organization is called Cure International. You can find them. Just do a Google of Cure International and find out what they do. This is the Faith Radio Network. I'm Bill Meyer. It's 28 past the hour. We're talking to Brant Hansen. We'll have more with Brant, talk about his new book, Unoffendable, up next. Stick with us.
Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio. Get ready to join the conversation. Now let's join Dr. Bill Meyer live.
Is it possible for Christians to be offended but be unoffendable? It's a radical, provocative idea. We are not actually entitled to get offended or stay angry, so says our guest today. The idea of righteous anger, he says, is a myth, and he believes it's the number one problem in society today. In fact, he quotes Dallas Willard, who says Christians have not been taught out of it. What about your right to experience righteous anger? It sounds like a really novel idea, but how does it work itself out in real life? And our guest, Brant Hansen, has written about that in his new book, Unoffendable, How Just One Change Can Make All of Life Better. And, Brant, you were really inspired by your own personal experience as a radio host to write this book. Is it true that you used to get offended on a regular basis by the people that would call in?
Oh, my goodness. I got offended at them being offended at everything. It's just funny. And now it's a national sport. I mean, everybody's offended about everything. And they feel like it makes them a little better, I guess. I mean, this is hardly just a Christian thing. It's all over the place. And people want to constantly be upset about everything. And, yeah, it's just the nature of the beast when you're in the media. But after a while, it dawned on me, like, am I going to continue to be shocked for the rest of my life that people misunderstand me, or that there's some crazy people in the audience, or that I've offended? So am I going to continue to be shocked by this? And I don't want to be. It takes up an awful lot of energy, and it doesn't accord with the real nature of the world, which is fallen. Why would I continually be in shock that my sister-in-law, my brother-in-law or my mom, I can't believe she said that again. Well, she's been saying that for 30 years. So, and we're just in this continual shock at the nature of man. And there's a scripture about Jesus where it says he knew how men thought. Nobody had to tell Jesus what men were like. Like, he's got it. And what I see, I know it sounds nuts. I know the idea of this sounds nuts at first. I would just encourage people, though, as we talk about it, like, please hold open the possibility that God wants to teach you and me something about this. Like, it's not just, I already know what I think about that. End of discussion. I already figured it out. I heard a 3-point sermon on it. Is it possible that even at this age, whatever age you are, that God's going to show you a new way of thinking, and that it's in accordance with the Bible? Maybe we've misunderstood something.
Now, there's a ton of research on how bitterness and resentment can negatively impact our lives physically and psychologically, certainly spiritually. And in fact, holding on to bitterness can actually shorten our lives. And I'm wondering, in your own case, personally, how did holding on to grudges affect you?
It comes out in a ton of different, seemingly unrelated ways, just with impatience in general, or my own spiritual life dragging. And there's unresolved anger going on. I haven't done the hard work to forgive somebody. And I know we feel like, but I'm entitled to it. This person really did this. Like, exactly. That's why forgiveness is called for. If they didn't really do that, and if it wasn't really wrong, you wouldn't have to forgive them. But that's the very thing a lot of times we think that justifies our quote unquote righteous anger is what we're supposed to forgive. And you can't simultaneously hold on to anger. I'm staying angry about this, and I forgive you. It's absurd. So it's one or the other. It's interesting because people will defend their right to anger, but then when we talk about forgiveness, oh yeah, I got to forgive. Well, how does that work? And again, scripturally, we're repeatedly told that anger resides in the lap of fools, for instance. Mm. It's always in the negative list in the Bible. It's not in the fruit of the Spirit. If it was righteous, there would be instances aplenty where God would go, good, be angry. That's not exactly what he says. And the most oft-quoted verse I hear about this is a half a verse, which is Ephesians 4:26. In your anger, do not sin. But the rest of the verse says, get rid of it before the sun goes down.
Mm-hmm.
So he's acknowledged all Paul is doing. And then later in the paragraph, he says, get rid of all anger. All anger. All he's doing is saying, you will get angry. It happens because we're human. We feel threats. That's natural. That's understandable. But we're not entitled to it. We have to drop it like a hot potato. We have to do the work of forgiving people. We need to address it right now so that it doesn't get a foothold.
Mm. One of the things that I think is important, and I know I'm sure we have listeners right now who are thinking about what you just said, and people who were really sinned against, especially maybe in their childhood, maybe neglect or abuse by someone that should have loved them and that, you know, they trusted. Explain, if you would, there's a big difference between, you know, this whole thing about forgive and forget. Forgiveness does not mean forgetting. It does not mean forgetting what happened to you. You need to fully acknowledge that. Otherwise, you can't truly forgive that person. And forgiveness also doesn't mean that you're going to make nice with that person, that somehow they're going to, respond to your act of forgiveness with love and sunshine and little sparrows and hearts, because that's not going to happen either, is it?
You know, when people see what happened in South Carolina with those families going in to confront Dylann Roof and saying, oh, we're forgiving you, you can say, he doesn't deserve it. Oh, no, you're right. He doesn't. He doesn't. And they're not doing it just for him. Like, their lives will be changed. They will not be consumed by bitterness. They will not be victimized for the rest of their lives by this. Jesus is giving us a way to be free. Make no mistake. But what he's doing, too, is not pretend. When he's on the cross and he's saying, forgive them for they don't know what they're doing, he's not saying, I'm just going to forget this. Whatever. There's no right and wrong. That's not what he's doing. But he is saying, while what they're doing is evil, I'm going to forgive them for it. I'm going to separate that person from the evil that they are committing. And they don't fully know what they're doing. I mean, as hard as it is to believe, people are justified in their own minds, and they can pass lie detectors. No, I'm doing the right thing here. I'm taking a stand for the white race or something. I mean, it's ridiculous how crimes get justified in the minds of people, or slights, or horrible evil. But they're deceived, and we're in a spiritual battle. And are we willing to love this person who is guilty and forgive them without? And it's at the same time, we're going, what you have done is evil. So no, there's no letting the idea that there's no evil or good or anything go. It's the scandal of grace of being able to say, I forgive you anyway, because of what God has, not because you deserve it, but because what God has done for me. God deserves me doing this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it's also important just psychologically to understand that this is not necessarily an emotion, it's really an act of the will. You may not feel in your heart like forgiving that person, certainly not initially. You may feel just the opposite. It is a conscious decision to say, I'm going to give up my right to get even with you. And that's one of the hardest things we can do.
It's excruciating. It almost feels like you're being crucified.
Hmm.
I mean, you are putting yourself to death so that you can live. To me, when Jesus said, deny yourself and take up your cross, this is a perfect example of it. I have to deny myself. This forces living unoffendably, deciding I'm going to walk in radical forgiveness, to me is discipleship.
Mm.
A huge, huge part of it that we're missing, because we think we've invented this thing called righteous anger for humans that's not in the Bible. God, yes, his anger is righteous. Yes, him in the temple, God in the Old Testament, New Testament, quite capable of anger, deserves it. He's holy. He's sinless. we are sinners. We have to extend forgiveness to others as he's forgiven us. Mm. We're the unmerciful servant if we don't forgive. But people want to act like, well, I'm just as entitled to it as God. No, you're not. Mm. No, I'm not, because of who we are. It is extremely freeing to do this. But yeah, it's excruciating, and the cost is always borne. There's a cost to forgiveness, and it's always borne by the forgiver.
Yeah.
It's hard, and you get a little bit of the taste of Christ's suffering when you do it, but that's kind of the point.
Mm. As you studied this and you've talked to others, I'm curious, why do you suppose we are so quick to be offended? Is it simply the sin nature, or do you think it also has something to do with the fact that we are made in God's image and that God is a God of justice?
I think we have an understanding of justice, but I think most of our anger, honestly, is we feel threatened at some level.
Mm.
It may just be that somebody's saying something that we know is wrong. 2 + 2 = 5, and it makes us mad because it's like it's invalidating what I'm saying. I can't believe you would say this. Like, what's going wrong with the world? It makes me feel threatened. I understand it. But I think that's why. I also think that is a function of spiritual immaturity, because if I became a Christian, I gave my life away, I should feel less threatened. I mean, for somebody who's not a believer to get cut off in traffic and to feel disrespected, like, oh, you're trying to leave me out of the village or something here. You're better than I am. You can cut me off. That's disrespect. I understand that, feeling that threat. But for somebody who's a believer going, what can you take from me? I gave everything. I don't have anything to protect anymore. Why? I can undefend myself. My defender is God. He's my fortress. I don't need to constantly be threatened anymore, but the people I know who are the most often offended are the people who have struggles being threatened all the time.
Mm-hmm.
One last point on that, if you don't mind. Tim Keller makes a great point about your elbow, and I mentioned it in the book. He says, you know, if you don't notice your elbow until it's inflamed, and then you're like, oh, I hit it on the cabinet, I hit it on this, you know, my elbow. You only notice something a lot when it's inflamed. And he said the same thing goes with your ego.
Mm.
Like if you're constantly being offended, it's probably because your ego is inflamed, that you are occupying more space than you need to. And the people I know who are the most mature believers are not being offended all the time. They're just not.
Mm. Is it really possible to live that way on a daily basis? Because it's I agree with you 100% on what you're saying, but the actual living it out, I mean, how do we do it? We get up in the morning and we go to work with that manipulative, controlling boss or that coworker that is just the thorn in our flesh. What do we do?
You know what? I'm going to actually have something concrete and maybe helpful to say on this. I think we have to be really mindful of what God has done for us. I think we have to be real. Like, it's not about clearing our minds so that we just drop things magically or anything like that. No, it's actually being reminded daily of how God has forgiven us. If you were guilty, if Bill Meyer, for whatever reason, was guilty of some capital offense and then you were let off the hook, you wouldn't be mad when somebody cut you off on your way home from the courthouse.
Hmm.
You'd be like, I can't believe how wonderful this day is. Oh, you know, go right ahead. I'm off the hook. I get to live.
Hmm.
I think we honestly think that we're pretty good people, so we deserve certain things. The scandal of the cross is that we're not. And we've already been exposed publicly for who we are. It happened 2,000 years ago on a hill. We've been exposed, and he let us off the hook. And if we really, maybe we start our day being reminded of that, but we live in the reality of that truth that we so often forget, I think we'll be more patient with people. I actually think this is a doable thing. I've seen it in my own life. I think all of Paul or in James, when he's talking about anger and he says to get rid of it, all this scriptural truth about getting rid of anger, I don't think it's naive. I think it's actually doable. So, yeah, I think it can happen.
Hmm. And I think probably what it really takes is that daily walk with God, drawing near to Him, learning His Word and His precepts, writing them on our hearts so that we understand that we've been forgiven of that capital offense. Because I think a lot of times we give it intellectual assent, but in our hearts we still feel, pretty good guy. I didn't murder anybody today, you know. I'm not committing adultery, so I'm pretty good.
Well, that's just it, and that's the thing when people go, well, look at the news, look at this, that happened, look at this. Well, the scandal is, and we should act against injustice, and we can talk about that clearly, obviously. I'm trying to do it with my life. But the scandal of the gospel is that I'm a murderer. If I've ever hated someone, I'm an adulterer if I've ever lusted after someone. Like, Jesus leveled the moral playing field. But we still want to act like I have a right to be angry at somebody else for the same thing that I'm guilty of. Instead of saying God is the judge, He'll sort it out, like Paul says in 1 Corinthians. He knows the inner motives of people. He knows their history. He knows their drives. You don't. Paul said, I can't even judge myself. I don't even know my own motives. But I have to leave it to God.
Hmm. The heart is desperately wicked above all things. Who can know it? Says Jeremiah. And I think a lot of us need to come to grips with that. Our guest is Brant Hansen, and Brant has written this new book called Unoffendable, How Just One Change Can Make All of Life Better. We actually have three copies of Brant's book to give away. And if you call us at 877-93-FAITH here in the next 10 minutes or so, we'll put you into a drawing at the end of the hour. You might just win a copy of Unoffendable. This is the Faith Radio Network. I'm Bill Meyer, and we're going to take a quick break. Be back with Brant Hansen. Stick with us.
Now, back to Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio.
Hey, if you haven't checked out our website, boy, we have some great resources there for you to grow in your faith, to strengthen your family, just some really cool stuff. You go to myfaithradio.com, myfaithradio.com. You can spend all day perusing some of those great articles and the podcasts of our regular programs Monday through Friday. If you haven't tuned in, if this is the first time listening to Faith Radio and you haven't joined us Monday through Friday, we have the best Bible teachers in the world on Faith Radio, not to mention our great local hosts. So join us if you would, maybe on your way to and from work, maybe if you've got time during the day at home. You will find that your faith will be strengthened, you'll be challenged, certainly, and you will grow. You'll become a better disciple of Jesus Christ by listening to Faith Radio on a daily basis. Well, my guest today, Brant Hansen, he's the author of Unoffendable, How Just One Change Can Make All of Life Better. And okay, Brant, here's a tough one for you. You say that really we have a misunderstanding that there is no such thing as righteous anger. So how do we respond to things like little girls in Cambodia who are being trafficked for sex, or ISIS dousing people with gasoline and burning them alive? When I see those things and hear about those things, I don't feel offended personally. I just feel angry. What's wrong with that?
Well, a couple things. Number one, if you're going to be angry about those things, it's an understandable reaction. I get it. Again, we're human. It happens. The Bible doesn't actually say get angry about that stuff, number one. Secondly, you realize there's a list that will take us all day. We could spend the rest of the broadcast day with things that you should be angry about. I mean, are we really going to make a commitment to my righteous anger is going to extend to everything? Mm. Because we can go to Boko Haram, and then I can just take you on a tour around Africa. I'll take you to the hospital in Afghanistan. We'll talk about how women are treated. Is everybody there angry right now about how newborn girls are treated in Afghanistan? Should I get you whipped into a frenzy about it? I mean, it's awful. To me, the issue isn't anger. The issue is action. And what's odd is what's really amazing. They've actually done a study about this, about people who are angry on Twitter and Facebook, and they found that a lot of times people replace action with just being publicly angry. They don't actually do anything about it.
That's
so I'll hear from people that are like, well, I watched the news and I saw this and I can't believe this happened and this and that and the other thing. Like, what are you doing about it? Nothing. So I find that really interesting. How am I supposed to respond? Dietrich Bonhoeffer agrees with me, by the way, on this anger issue. He wrote that you can't find righteous anger in Jesus' teachings. Hmm. He doesn't draw that distinction. We made that up. This is according to Bonhoeffer. And here's a guy who tried to assassinate Adolf Hitler.
Hmm.
It wasn't out of anger, because sometimes you do things because it's the right thing to do, and you're driven by compassion for people. You have no choice. You have to intervene because there's evil in the world. Sometimes it requires force. I'm not a pacifist, by the way, but I actually think a lot of men in particular are like, well, I'm angry about this because I'm a man.
Hmm.
No. The masculine thing to do would be to take action, to defend the vulnerable, defend the least of these, and defend the weak and the ill and the sick. That's the masculine thing. And I imagine any wife listening would be like, yeah, that's right. I don't want my husband being angry at home. I want him to be a man of action. And that's actually attractive even. So I think we confuse, because we've decided that anger is righteous, we've actually decided that it must be a good thing. Therefore, I've done my duty by being angry about this.
You just stop there. You get upset.
Yeah.
You can't believe it. You rant and rave about it, but then nothing ever happens.
So how about we be like Jesus, where we look on crowds with compassion and we act? How about that? I mean, I don't understand why. And it doesn't mean you're devoid of passion in life. It doesn't mean that you don't care. It's just because you have to pray for your enemies. And when you pray for your enemies, you have to pray in a spirit of forgiveness towards them, because you're just as guilty. And then you act. I'll say one other thing about this, too. While we confuse, well, what do we do about, how can we do anything about injustice without anger? I hear this question all the time. If I'm not angry, I won't do anything. Well, A, I would say that's immature. You should be able to do things without anger. B, don't we require that of our police? We don't want them acting out of anger, but we've got them in the very position they're in order to address injustice. The best way to address injustice is not having our vision clouded by anger. Same thing with our military. I don't want them acting out of anger. Same thing with the judges. I don't want our justice system acting out of anger. That's a ticket to injustice.
Mm.
I want clear-headed action to defend the vulnerable. And I find among the mature Christian people I know, they're not marked by anger. They're marked by grieving the way the world is, and then loving their enemies and then acting.
You know, it's fascinating, as you were just describing that with the police and the military and the judges. I was thinking about some of these recent incidents with police officers. And certainly, I think some of that's been blown out of proportion by the media, which is just as tragic. But the situations where there truly has been injustice, it's often because the police officer got angry and acted out of their anger, and then a terrible thing happened.
Anger does not enhance our judgment. It hurts it. This is why, again, as much as I hear constant, because I've written this book, people advancing non-biblical ideas about how good anger is. I'm like, but that's not what the Bible says. The Bible says it lives in the lap of a fool. Then James 1:20, for people who are like, well, yeah, but there is righteous anger. James 1:20 says there isn't. There's nothing about human anger that brings about the righteousness of God. And even though it says that, people will keep going, no, it does. And so it's fascinating to me. We've developed this theology around anger, and it's based on half a verse and not the second half. We have to ignore all this other stuff in order to justify our anger and make us feel good about it.
Well, we're really good at that. I've noticed you take other verses and, you know, we're good at the half verse,
totally.
You know, take that out of context and boy, I'm going to defend the faith. I'm going to always have a reason,
right.
You know, to boy. And then of course they miss the next part of what Peter says with winsomeness and respect. Oops. Okay.
Yeah. That's just it.
So boy, good stuff, Brent. We're running out of time here and I just feel like we've scratched the surface of this wonderful book. And again, I want to commend it to our listeners. It's Unoffendable, how just one change can make all of life better. In just the minute we have left, talk to the person right now who is kind of just struggling with what you have to say.
Yeah.
What can they do today to start this journey towards healing and wholeness and living in a more biblical way when it comes to their anger?
I would say please think over what we've been saying. If you get the book right, but please think over what we've been saying, that it's possible that that's what God wants to do in your life. And Jesus may be leading you towards freedom, where you're not owned by these people anymore. They don't occupy the space in your head anymore. You're able to let what they've done leave your system and finally be able to be in the moment again with your family and not consumed by conflict, because God created you to thrive. He knows. And that's why he's telling us to forgive others. Plus, look what he's done for you. So mm-hmm. I would just say extend that for other people and see if that isn't exactly what actually Scripture is telling us to do, to forgive.
Brant, thank you so much for your time today. Pray that God will continue to use you, and you've got a powerful message. I wanted to get out there to as many people as possible. Once again, the book is called Unoffendable, How Just One Change Can Make All of Life Better.